Graham Thompson versus Thomas White. And I guess we hear from you again, Mr. Goldman.
Thank you. May it please the court, counsel. My name is Jonathan Goldman. I'm here on behalf of Graham Thompson. This is a case about whether Mr. Thompson filed his EEO complaint with the federal government, the Army, within 45 days of the date of harm. And a little background, Mr. Thompson worked for the Army for about 30 years. He was an EEO manager at the end. He was discharged in 91, and pursuant to a settlement, he was allowed to resign effective November of 1994. He actively searched for other federal employment starting in 1991, but he was continually denied employment. In December of 1996, this triggering event, he was told that he could not obtain retirement benefits because he was not actively employed by the federal government at the time. Whether that the information was right or wrong, it was that information which led him to believe, to conclude, that the whole reason he was denied federal employment between 91 and 96 was because of activities of the Army. Within 45 days of that December 1996 statement by the Retirement Board, he went and filed an EEO action.
What was this? How was that a triggering event? I'm not sure I can connect those.
That was the moment in time, and he can trace it back to that day, where he realized that what was happening was that he was being retaliated against by the Army with regard to other federal employment. An individual who he had known while working at the Army had made a comment to him that Mr. Thompson was never going to work for the Army again, and he was never going to work for the government again.
When was that comment made?
That comment was made while he was back in the early 90s.
That didn't trigger it.
That, well, he hadn't started looking for a job at that point. It all came together for him in this 1996 interaction with the Retirement Board, and that is exactly what he put in his EEO charge in January of 1997.
But didn't he say in his deposition that he wrote that March 1995 letter because he thought the Army was blackballing him?
There's a little discrepancy with regard to that, Your Honor. There's nothing specifically... First of all, the letter you're referring to is addressed to the Retirement Board, not to the Army.
No, but that doesn't matter. If he already is aware, if he's on notice that the Army's doing something wrong, he has an obligation to file his complaint. So he could have written it to Santa Claus. I mean, as long as he knows it,
well,
he
made that statement in his deposition after the district court case was filed, and at that point he had the advantage of 20/20 hindsight. When the letter was written, it doesn't say anything about his concern that the Army had retaliated against him. If anything, it indicated a concern that the Railroad Retirement Board, the receiver of that letter, may have had some role in discriminating against him because of his race, gender, or age. Again, he didn't realize, and he's testified to this, he didn't realize until after he went to the Retirement Board in 96 that the Army had some role in retaliating against him. That's what he put in his EEO complaint, and that's what his thinking was at the time that he made the complaint against the Army. We've provided argument in our briefs that this triggering event and his justification for waiting until that period of time constitutes a valid time for filing the EEO charge. And if there's not any other questions, then I'll rest.
Okay, thanks.
Thank you.
Mr. Miller?
Thank you, Your Honor. May it please the court, counsel. In his deposition in this case, Mr. Thompson admitted over and over again that he suspected or knew of the retaliation and blackballing now alleged by him during the 1991 to 1995 period. And yet, even though he himself was a manager within the EEO department for the Army Corps of Engineers, he failed to contact an EEO counselor until January of 1997. As a result of that very substantial multi-year delay, which is of course way beyond the 45-day applicable limitations period, this action is untimely and the district court should be affirmed. I'd like to give a couple of quick examples, very brief examples, of the types of admissions that Mr. Thompson made in his deposition, just to make this clear. And I should add that the whole of his deposition is in the record. It's exhibit number 2 to record item number 11. Mr. Thompson's primary allegation is that Mr. Charlie Laycock, who was an attorney he knew when he was still working for the Army, retaliated against and blackballed Mr. Thompson after he left the Army in 1991. And in particular, what he alleges is that Mr. Laycock was somehow disseminating negative references about Mr. Thompson to other federal agencies or other federal employers. On page 128 of his deposition, I asked Mr. Thompson point blank when he first came to the conclusion that he was being blackballed. His answer was, when I was removed in 1991. Then he went on to explain on that same page, also in 1992. I don't think it can be any more clear than that.
Could I just ask you a factual question about the record, Mr. Miller?
Sure.
In this settlement agreement, way back when, I guess in 1991, when the Army agreed to amend his records to reflect a voluntary resignation, were those records ever introduced into the record of this proceeding? Do we have in this record something that would show whether he left because of a voluntary resignation or because of some allegation about falsifying travel vouchers?
We do. It's actually exhibit number 3 to record item number 11, and what that is the single page. It's the document that shows him leaving the Army as a voluntary resignation. I think it actually just says resignation, to be accurate.
Okay.
It doesn't have the word voluntary in there. But yes, it's right there, and it's in box 5B of that document. And you'll see that actually at the bottom of that same document, it's written that this is being done pursuant to the settlement and describes some of the other settlement terms.
Okay. Thank you.
Another example of asking Mr. Thompson about his knowledge at the deposition, I asked him on page 137, did he ever talk to his family about Mr. Laycock? He said, absolutely, yes. I did that throughout the whole period, 1991 to 95. Then on the very next page 138, I asked Mr. Thompson this question. Quote, after your removal in June of 1991, when you were telling your family about Charlie Laycock, did you believe there was any connection between him and your inability to get a federal job? His answer was, definitely. Again, I think that's just crystal clear. Based on these types of answers and many, many others like that, we believe the district court correctly found that this action is time barred. And I'd refer the court to pages 128 to 46 of the deposition to see the long version of these many admissions in there. There's three basic arguments that Mr. Thompson has presented to this court in order to rebut the district court's finding. The first argument is based on his affidavit, where he says, in my affidavit, I say I only suspected blackballing as of December 1996. We think the answer to that is pretty straightforward. It's just that the district court found that directly contradicts the deposition testimony. On top of that, there's no explanation in the affidavit as to why there's this incredible inconsistency between the deposition testimony and the affidavit. And as a result of that, the affidavit could not defeat summary judgment. And there's certainly plenty of Seventh Circuit cases that say that, and those are cited in the brief. Beyond that, I'd like to add what is also discussed in some of the Seventh Circuit cases, which is that this principle against last-minute affidavits, which contradict prior testimony, is really a crucial part of summary judgment proceedings. And that's because, of course, almost any plaintiff can always go back and later contradict their prior testimony. And if that is sufficient to defeat summary judgment, then the district court is just going to be flooded with employment discrimination trials, even in cases where it's frivolous or totally meritless, and of course that's exactly what summary judgment is designed to prevent. I'd also add although counsel has presented the court with some very vague explanations as to why there might be this discrepancy. For example, he said, well, it was just 20/20 hindsight. Those explanations are actually not in the affidavit itself. So there's actually no competent evidence giving that sort of explanation. And counsel's explanation is not competent evidence and therefore can't defeat summary judgment on that basis. The second argument by Mr. Thompson is the continuing violation argument, where he tries to link the 91 to 95 period where he wasn't getting these jobs to the December 1996 alleged denial of his retirement. Couple of reasons why we believe that should be rejected. First of all, the Office of Personnel Management, not the Army, has exclusive jurisdiction over determining retirement eligibility. And as a result of that, the Human Resources Army employee that Mr. Thompson says he spoke to about his retirement could not possibly, as a legal matter, have denied him his retirement. It's just not legally possible. And I'd actually refer the court to record item number 10, page 6 of that. That is the Army's memorandum that it submitted in the district court, and that explains in detail that the basis for the OPM's exclusive jurisdiction over this issue. A second reason why the continuing violation argument doesn't work is because Mr. Thompson suspected the blackballing long ago. That's just a bar to that type of argument. Another bar to it is there's no evidence of him acting diligently. And then a last reason that argument should fail is because this alleged denial of retirement was not itself discriminatory. It was just a later effect of this earlier blackballing that he alleged, and those arguments are set out in the brief. The last argument that Mr. Thompson has presented to this court is his argument that he seems to suggest, at least in his affidavit, that he applied for federal jobs through 1997 as opposed to just through 1995. And perhaps that's meant to suggest that maybe some application and some denial occurred within the applicable 45-day period. That argument fails, we believe, because once again, that just directly contradicts his deposition testimony. Once again, he has no explanation for that inconsistency, and of course, that can't defeat summary judgment in that circumstance. I'd also want to add, even if the court were to just look at that at the affidavit in isolation, it alone would not be sufficient to overcome summary judgment because it doesn't detail any specific job applications or rejections within the 45-day period. So it doesn't identify specific instances. And of course, in order to overcome summary judgment, the respondent needs to identify specific facts or specific instances. Just a general statement about maybe I applied until 1997 would not be sufficient. If there are no further questions at this point, we would ask that the district court be affirmed.
Thank you. Mr. Goldman, do you have anything to add? Okay, thanks. Were you appointed in this one? No, you weren't. Okay. Well, in case we take it under advisement, that will complete the arguments for the day, and the court will be in recess for a couple of weeks, I guess.